Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today, 16th of March, we will continue listening to Master Tenzin Chosen's previous program, Meditation, Dying, and Karma. And please enjoy.
Those who were with us a couple of weeks back may remember the Sri Lankan greeting when I used it for the first time. It means, the Buddha's blessings be with you, and I certainly hope they are. In the last few weeks, we've been talking about the causes for our suffering, and although most people would cite bad relationships, thieves, politicians, and so on, if we look more carefully, we will see that our misery comes not from anything outside of ourselves, but from within. The way we view the world and react to it causes the problem, not the way the world presents itself to us. This is very easily seen by the different ways people approach a problem or difficulty. Let's say, for instance, you were one of the people whose luggage was stolen by a couple I read about recently who lived in Vermont in the United States. Evidently, these two regularly dropped off at the airport, lifted someone's bag off the baggage carousel, and went home with it. When the police raided their house, it was strewn with bags and their contents nicked from the airport. Now, if one of those was yours, how would you have reacted when you couldn't find your luggage and the airline wouldn't do anything about the loss? Some people would, of course, be very angry. Others would be mostly upset, and a few might even be just philosophical about it. If you were one of the people who became angry or upset, wouldn't you go through a lot of suffering on the loss of the bag? But comparatively, how much misery would you go through if you took the attitude, well, these things happen, and continued with life, perhaps a little inconvenienced, but largely unaffected? People's reactions one way or another would not get the baggage back. It would be presumably lost forever. But those reactions would certainly affect their lives in one way or another. This is a fairly gross example of how we cause our own suffering. There's little we can do about the airport thieves or many other misfortunes that befall us, but we can certainly change our reactions to them so that they don't give us more unhappiness than necessary. Let's say I'm a thief and get some kind of satisfaction making people suffer through my robberies. Perhaps it gives me a kind of perverted sense of power. It'll not be difficult to find someone to rob. In New Zealand from the 1st of July last year to the 30th of June this year, the police recorded nearly 114,000 thefts. If I steal from someone and they get very upset, I've established my most complete power over them. Not only did I get their property, but I caused them a lot of anguish as well. Every time they think of the theft, they will become miserable. So my power over them extends long after the theft. However, if they get over the theft with little suffering, the only damage I've done is relieved them of their property. And if insurance is involved, that may only be an inconvenience, but certainly no tragedy. Even if the stolen goods are not insured, if my victims aren't made particularly miserable about my theft, I've essentially failed in my aim of making them suffer. They've refused to give me any power over them. Many emotional reactions causing us to suffer are enumerated in the Buddhist scriptures. Over the last few weeks, we listed the main six: attachment, aversion, ignorance, pride, doubt, and wrong views. We considered them faulty, particularly when considering long-term happiness, but they play their part in the short term as well. In our example of theft, it is obvious that the more we are attached to our property, the more hurt we will be when it's stolen. But if we regard things as only on loan to us for a short time, at some time in the future they wear out, or will be given away, broken, sold, or stolen, then we don't attach much importance to them, and so don't get miserable when eventually we have to part from them one way or the other. We also talked in previous programs about the factors that give rise to afflictive emotions and the ways in which they harm us. Of course, if we pay attention to the things that cause us to develop and increase the afflictive emotions, we will just create and intensify our own future suffering. For instance, we have latencies in our mind that will ripen into afflictive emotions when the outer conditions are right. A person we don't like can ripen a latency of irritation, for instance. We're also surrounded by objects that cause the afflictive emotions to arise. The smell of coffee can cause desire to leap up in the mind. Our friends are great influences on us as well. They can easily encourage a negative emotional reaction, especially attachment. Also, movies, TV shows, books, and so on that we involve ourselves in can stir the afflictions, as can our familiarity with an afflictive emotion itself. The more familiar we are with anger, for instance, the more spontaneously it will arise. And then, if we continually let our mind dwell on an object of the afflictive emotions, the stronger those emotions will get. Now, if these are the factors that stir up the afflictive emotions, it makes sense then to be careful to avoid or minimize them as much as possible. Because, as we pointed out in the last program, there's no greater enemy than the afflictive emotions. They have so many faults and cause us so much damage that in the whole world, even in the whole universe, we will not be able to find anything to match their destructiveness. It's often pointed out in the Buddhist scriptures that a worldly enemy can only cause us problems until this life is over, but the afflictive emotions cause problems continuously, life after life. They never let us rest. If we look for the fuel that drives us through cyclic existence, it is the afflictive emotions. For even though we may have a huge store of negative karma, it cannot be ripened and so cannot harm us without the afflictive emotions. Some years ago, the Baha men had a hit called "Who Let the Dogs Out?" And if we change dogs to suffering, the answer would be the afflictive emotions. If you were with us during the last program, you will remember we went through all the difficulties that the afflictive emotions bring us, like preventing us from doing actions that will bring happiness in the future, destroying our moral discipline, causing virtues and qualities to degenerate, hampering livelihood by causing disunity in the workplace, causing conflicts, arguments, and bad reputation, landing us in rebirths where we can't practice the Dharma, damage our knowledge and attainments, preventing us from gaining new realizations and attainments, and causing mental tension, agitation, and suffering. All these are the work of the afflictive emotions. So who needs them? So that's a summary of what we've covered over the last couple of weeks. Now let's consider how karma is created in dependence on the afflictive emotions. But just before we do that, take a moment to think about your motivation for tuning into Dharma Radio today. Of course, it may just be the station you happen to land on as you twiddled with the radio dial. But even so, you can stop for a moment and consider why you're listening. If it's just for some temporary happiness, that is the best you can ever hope for from this program. It will be similar to tuning into any talkback or music station. You won't remember much of what went on after you switched the radio off. Perhaps a word here or there, a sentence or two, but not much would have sunk in. If, however, your motivation is to gain liberation from your suffering, or even better, to help others free themselves from their suffering, and so you're listening to gain enlightenment for that, the positive effects will be much greater. The positive energy will even remain working for you until you actually become enlightened. So it's a good idea to make our motivation as vast as possible, and if you can, then think you are participating so that you can become enlightened to help all others do the same. That will be the best. Thank you. Now to continue with the question of karma. The two main causes of our misery are afflictive emotions and karma. And as I said earlier, of these two, the prime one is the afflictive emotions. Even if we had several million tetrabytes of negative karma, if we were free of afflictive emotions, that karma would have nothing to activate it, and so we wouldn't suffer its consequences. So how do we create karma through the afflictive emotions? To answer this, we define two kinds of karma: the karma of intention and the intended karma. The karma of intention is a mental factor that acts as a conceiver of an action. As its name says, it is the intention that comes before an action. The intended karma, on the other hand, is what is going on in the mind when the action is being done. So, for instance, you're at a tea party where a delicious-looking cake is on the table, ready for the eating. You stand beside the table, eyeing the cake. A karma of intention arises when you decide, to hell with your weight, you're going to have a piece of cake. Then the intended karma is born as you munch into your piece of cake with great enjoyment and probably lots of attachment. Ordinary people like myself generate karma continuously based on our self-grasping ignorance. Say I have a great liking for cake with lots of creamy icing. You invite me to your birthday get-together, and like we said before, you have a very enticing cake on the table, which people are in due course invited to help themselves to. Now, I have an instinctual grasping at a real independent me that loves real independent gooey cake. Thinking that this cake is good for me, I develop attachment for it, and so by grabbing and devouring a slice, I create karma. It's an action created by attachment, so the karma binds me to cyclic existence and will have negative consequences in the future. Or perhaps my attachment is so strong that I indulge in a second slice of cake and maybe even a third. The karma is strengthened by my greed, and I may even experience an immediate suffering karmic result when after the third or fourth slice I have to rush to the bathroom to be sick. Now let's say I'm a labor supporter. Based on my perception that I'm a real and independent individual and John Key is also a real and independent individual, I may develop a dislike for the Prime Minister. Then, whatever he does, I disagree with, even if it benefits a lot of people. And I might criticize him whenever I get a chance, thereby creating a lot of negative karma. Do you see how karma is created? It is said that even positive karma created by ordinary beings, that is karma motivated by non-harm, love, compassion, and so on, has to be abandoned eventually because it is still based on this ignorance that grasps at things existing independently and inherently, and it still binds us to cyclic existence. When we become arhats or superior beings, that is when we no longer have this self-grasping ignorance, we no longer create karma that binds us in this way. The karma we create is non-contaminated meritorious karma. Non-contaminated here means that's not polluted by any of the afflictive emotions. When we realize the true nature of self and phenomena, seeing directly, and that directly is an important word, that self and phenomena don't have even an atom of inherent, independent, permanent existence, we immediately stop creating negative karma, and all our negative karma is crushed, like a powerful person crushes a weaker one. So, for instance, as an arhat, I might still be a labor supporter, and I might still not agree with some of the things that John Key does. But because I see that neither I nor John Key exists as an independent, inherent being, I do not criticize him out of a mistaken emotion of dislike. He may pass a law that puts an extra tax on people who have an income of less than $20,000, and I may criticize it as a discriminatory and harmful law. But seeing both John Key and the law as processes of causes and conditions, I will have no reason to generate hatred, and so will not be influenced by negative karma or have to experience its effects. The karma we create can be meritorious or unmeritorious. As you can imagine, meritorious karma leads to pleasant experiences, and when we talk about rebirths, this type of karma will impel us to be reborn in the higher realms. Say you meet the Buddha's teachings, but decide that at the moment it is too hard to work towards liberation or enlightenment. The best you can do is try for a high rebirth, and so you take precepts, live a very ethical life, and practice with that in mind. When the moment of death arrives, if positive karma through your practice arises, you could be born in one of the three higher states of the desire realm. That is the human, asura, or god states. This type of karma is called fluctuating meritorious karma, and I'll explain why in a moment. There is another type of meritorious karma called unfluctuating meritorious karma, which comes from being disgusted with the pleasures of the desire realm, but being caught up in either the pleasure of concentration or developing equanimity. When we develop a strong meditation on just concentration, we can have quite blissful experiences. And if the karma associated with it arises at death, it will result in rebirth in one of the levels of the form realm, where beings have a form but spend a long time in very pleasurable existence. Similarly, when you give up even the bliss of concentration to cultivate a mind of equanimity, when you die, such a karma will result in a rebirth in the fourth level of the form realm, or in one of the three levels of the formless realm, where you have no physical form but can remain in an absorbed mental state for eons. Now, the difference between fluctuating and unfluctuating karma is that the first, fluctuating karma, can be changed after you die and are still in the intermediate state between one life and the next. Say, for instance, at the moment of death, a karma arises that will result in your rebirth as an animal in the next life. But then your close relatives and some monks do positive practices which they dedicate to you. That can change the karma, and you could be born as a human instead of an animal in your next life. That doesn't mean the karma to be born as an animal has been destroyed. It means that instead of that karma ripening this time, another karma has been strengthened enough to override the karma that ripened at death time. Of course, it works the other way as well. If you are destined by your karma at death time to be born as a god, but in the bardo, the intermediate state, you have a vision in which you develop a lot of anger, that positive karma could be replaced by one that sends you to a hell realm instead. Unfluctuating karma only arises through developing a powerful meditation practice based on a mind that is no longer interested in the pleasures of cyclic existence, but focuses instead on concentration or equanimity. Now, this karma cannot be changed in the intermediate state. If through this karma you are destined for the first level of the formless realm, for instance, that is where you will end up, no matter what practices your relatives or teachers do for you. Karma that brings rebirth in the desire realm is always fluctuating. So it's always a good idea when your loved ones die to do something to try and change any negative karma that may have arisen and which will send them into a life of great suffering. All the Buddhist traditions have practices that can help in this, and it's common to all for the monks to be asked to do ceremonies that will pass merit onto relatives and friends who have died. We also cannot say, oh, so-and-so led a good life, and so will be born in a good place, and I don't have to worry about him or her. We all created both positive and negative karmas in our lives, and even though the dead person might have tried to behave predominantly well during his or her life, one of those negative karmas might have ripened at death time, and he or she might be then on their way to a lower realm rebirth. We just can't tell. So it's helpful to do what we can for those who died, even though they might have lived what seemed to us impeccable lives. Now, perhaps this is a good time to talk a little bit more about death and rebirth. If I were to ask you when you would die, unless you were suffering a terminal disease, you would probably not be able to tell me. However, if I asked you whether you will die or not, you would have to say yes. These two facts, that we don't know when we will die, but that we will definitely do so, make it important that we consider death now. Of course, if I know that I will definitely die in 2 months' time, I have a much better idea of how to plan for it. But tomorrow could be my last day in this life, and so it's best if I thought about it now. Then if I asked what people most fear about death, probably they would say the unknown, or the pain that might go with death. Tibetan Buddhists have a very great interest in death, because a certain moment in the death process is very close to the enlightened experience, and if you can capture that moment and use it in meditation, it is easy to become fully enlightened. So the Tibetans have made a detailed study of the death process and describe it in a number of stages. If we can become familiar with these stages and recognize them as we go through the death process, it will remove the fear of the unknown that could make death a very unpleasant experience for us. Advanced practitioners in the Tibetan tradition, and maybe other traditions, can use the death process to become fully enlightened. But most of us will have to go through death and into the intermediate state between lives. So let's look at that now. We can describe three circumstances that will lead to death. If all three are present, it's time to go and nothing further can be done. But if only one or two are present, certain practices and activities could lengthen your lifespan. The first of the three is death due to the exhaustion of the karma that determined your lifespan. When we talked about karma, you may remember we described throwing karma and completing karma. Throwing karma has the power to throw us into another life. So when I die as Tenzin, a throwing karma could arise that will propel me into my next life. Then completing karma is the karma that decides on my experiences in that life. If the completing karma is negative and based on my previous actions of harming beings, it may be that I have a weak body and poor health. When the completing karma for the life finishes, then a person will die. The second circumstance leading to death is exhaustion of merit. At the moment, most of us in New Zealand have enough food to keep us going and good shelter. This is due to our merit, or if you like, the causes for happiness that came about through our creating positive karma in the past. Positive karma and merit are not the same, because merit can be form, consciousness, energy, or latency. The Buddha's arm, for instance, arises from merit. When our merit runs out, it can mean death. For instance, if we can no longer find anything to eat or drink, like some of the people in the drought-stricken areas of Africa. Although under normal circumstances, they would have longer to live because due to their lack of merit to overcome the drought, their necessities of life run out and life ends. Conversely, a huge store of merit could extend your lifespan beyond the time that the completing karma runs out. The third circumstance is loss of power in the life force. In other words, our life force becomes so weak that it can no longer sustain life. An example of this is when someone who is suffering from an illness takes the wrong type of medicine, or someone who grossly overeats. The texts talk about seven such conditions apart from those two: eating unsuitable food, eating before digesting a previous meal, not going to the toilet for a long time, vomiting food, not having the necessary abilities, like, for instance, playing in a river though you don't know how to swim, traveling at the wrong time, as in walking a long distance in the midday sun of a hot country, and, perhaps surprisingly, excessive sexual activity. Anyway, whether you are able to avoid such situations and do long life practices to help you live to 123, we will still die one day, and then our state of mind will be the most important, as mind is all that goes with us when we leave one life for the next. The process of death I'm going to describe comes from the Tibetan Buddhist teachings. Other traditions approach it differently and have different descriptions for the death process. When we die, we go through eight stages of death, during which grosser levels of mind stop functioning and the consciousness becomes more and more subtle. As the gross consciousnesses we usually operate with in our everyday lives die out, we experience subtle consciousnesses, which are actually neutral. The last moment of gross consciousness is the moment we have to watch out for, because the karma that ripens at that time determines the sort of life we will have coming up. So, for instance, I'm a human in this life, but if I'm careless with morality and pick up a lot of bad karma, a time will come that I'm on my deathbed and the karma for a sheep rebirth arises at the last moment of death. Without any further help from my family or friends, the chances are very great that I will be born a sheep. That last state of gross conceptual mind can be virtuous, non-virtuous, or neutral. In the case where a person becomes a sheep, the mind is, of course, non-virtuous. A virtuous state of mind will come from your familiarity with such a mind state, or if, as you die, someone shows you pictures of your spiritual teacher, your guru, or recites prayers over you, and so on, so that such a virtuous mind arises. Now, generally, the thoughts, virtuous or non-virtuous, most familiar to us will arise at death, And if virtue and non-virtue are equally familiar to us, whichever was committed first tends to arise. Maybe previous to becoming a monk, a man was attached to fishing and killed a lot of fish. Then, after he became a monk, he gave up killing altogether, though the previous karma of killing remained active. Now, as he is dying, the karma created from killing and the karma created from not killing are equally strong in his mind. Then the killing karma, because it was created first, will tend to arise before any karma created on the basis of not killing. It's said that those who have created virtue will experience going from darkness to light and not have fearful hallucinations and will die peacefully. Now say when you are dying, someone reminds you of your enemy or shows you pictures of them. Perhaps they encourage you to remember the harm your enemy caused you, and through that you generate an angry, vengeful mind that stays with you until the gross states of mind have dissolved and only the subtle, neutral states of mind remain. At that point, whatever people say or do cannot affect you, nor can you remember virtue or non-virtue. But the angry state of mind of your final moment of gross consciousness will impel you towards a miserable rebirth, and you will experience going from light into darkness with frightening hallucinations. In this state, it's very unlikely that you will have a peaceful death. If, however, at death time, neither virtuous nor non-virtuous thoughts occur, and you neither suffer nor experience any pleasure, whether you will have a positive or negative rebirth depends on your general overall accumulation of virtue or non-virtue. Whichever is greater will tend to dominate, and so propel you towards a happy rebirth if virtue dominates, or suffering if non-virtue is greater. So you see, it's very important when we are with someone who is dying that we try our best to make virtuous thoughts arise in their mind and that their last moments are as peaceful and as unfrightening as we can make them. If they don't know they are in fact dying, and we know that they would be very fearful if they did know, it's best not to say anything about it, but to encourage them to feel relaxed and cared for. Perhaps you can say you're praying for their quick recovery and long life. Of course, it's different with strong-minded people who understand impermanence and not afraid of death. Generally, it's not a good idea to cause disturbance and agitation around a dying person. Some cultures have a tradition of wailing and making a big fuss as the person is dying, but in Buddhism, we believe this is not helpful at all and can cause many problems for the dying person. Rather, everything should be done to maintain a calm, peaceful atmosphere and, if possible, to recite Dharma prayers or sutras or the names of Buddhas like Amitabha. But we will continue this discussion next week, providing, of course, I live long enough to record it. But now we've run out of time. Thank you for joining us. We'll be here again next week at the same time. I hope you'll be here with us again. Please dedicate any positive energy we have accumulated to attaining enlightenment, to help not only yourself, but all beings everywhere. Thank you and goodbye.